Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves. And this is going to be a very exciting discussion. I think you guys are going to get a kick out of it. I'm fascinated. I have with us today as our guest, Teresa Nesbitt. She's a retired OBGYN, people doctor, with a lot of background in studying skeletal issues. Yes, Teresa, would that be right? Skeletal issues?
Dysplasia, sort of abnormal or abnormalities in bones and cartilage.
And now you are an owner and very involved with the Glenavon Mall Terrier breed, correct?
And dachshunds, yes.
And dachshunds, yes. So we are talking about wraparound fronts and all of the components of that that make these breeds so distinct from other breeds.
It's a very interesting puzzle.
Yes.
So to me, as I started to go about this, it was very much how I would have done puzzles in the first place, which is, I always sorted things out and got my corners and all my straight lines and then started filling out the inner bits. And you have to find for what hooks up to what. And when you have a rare breed, I have a more common breed with the dachshunds and a more rare breed with the Glenavon Mall Terriers. So you go and you say, what are these similarities? And you find out people who've done a lot of it with the other breeds that fall into this category that is sometimes called dwarf breeds or achondroplastic or short-legged. And there's a lot of overlap and there's a lot of language that can be hard to understand. And people aren't necessarily talking about the same thing when they do it. So no one's going to give you a medical school examination on the definitions of these, what I call jargon and is often called medical terminology to just make you sound smart. So to me, it's always better is to just understand how it works and then you can apply it in a lot of different situations. So that's why I thought that this came up in an interesting way because Glens aren't dachshunds, but there are some similarities.
Right.
And we really start off with in my field. So I was interested in the genetics and the expression of dwarfism, which if you've seen Game of Thrones, Tyrion Lannister, and we know like the little people shows and things like that. So most people are familiar with what we would refer to as this disproportionate dwarfism, which is what looks like a large head or certainly a normal size head and length of spine, but the limbs are very short. This is the form of dwarfism. We call it micromelic. It just means short-limbed or disproportionate that is in my breeds. But there's actually, now that we understand how it occurs, and we've just recently found the gene or the genes now that contribute to what brings this on, it turns out it's a very, very old gene. It's a very interesting kind of gene in that you literally made a second copy and it snuck back into the nucleus and puts itself on the recipe book. So there's two copies and the second one doesn't have instructions. So we call it a retrogene. So it's a fascinating field right now because understanding some of these things and how genes turn on and off, which is more important than the actual gene now, is going to help us understand a lot of things about cancers and things like that. Is why do these genes turn on and off and at what times and what brings that on. So that's always fascinating in medicine is, you open a door and it leads you into a completely new direction.
Right.
But, certainly women that would come to me that had chondroplastic disorders, that were dwarves, they don't have a normal shaped pelvis. So they would have obstetric problems as my patient, just the adult woman. Mm-hmm. Or you could also look at it as we know that they have this genetic form of inheritance. So we would look and see what would be happening with their baby because two parents that are both dwarves can actually have a normal limb length baby. And we are going to stick to the kind today to be talking about short-leggedness, which is intentional, which is for purpose-bred dogs, which is my preferred expression. I prefer that to purebred dogs.
Sure.
I really like purpose-bred dogs. And there has been a number of purposes over time for these short-legged dogs. And they've been around for thousands of years. There's drawings of them. And they have found the gene that creates this in the gray wolf. Not, they didn't have it expressed, but we now know that it was there to be inherited. And so it's a very interesting gene that popped up in many places and became a purpose-bred gene. Because depending on what task you wanted to do, a dwarf dog can do different tasks in different environments. So as people would find out, oh, this is really helpful in this situation, they would try and increase the likelihood of getting that trait, which is similar to exactly what we're doing right now with our dogs. Is what we like, we try and make more of, and what we don't want, we try and avoid.
Yes.
So it's not really changed. I mean, the whole art of it is certainly the same. So you can look at the jobs that were the most common, which would be the terriers and the dachshunds. Dachshund actually means badger dog in German, and it actually came, the whole dachs came from badger crawler and badger catcher. So they're not terriers, but they share this idea of, like the terriers that go to earth, that they started off as being hunting vermin that we wanted to get rid of. But in the British Isles in particular, they started to find that chasing these feisty vermin around was very entertaining sport for the gentry, so to speak. So everybody knows about fox hunting, but most people weren't aware. Obviously, dog people know that there's otter hounds and Airedales and dandies that hunt. The terriers and the otter hounds would hunt together for otter. And the badger was always considered to be the most dangerous and require the most experienced dogs to go after. And their den is a little bit different. So when they started breeding these short-legged terriers, they found it was quite useful because a badger set, which is where they live, and sometimes fox will live in there too, is like a series of tubes and chambers. So you'd want the dog to go down, and for the most part, what these dogs are going to do is they have to be very loud, like terriers. They have to call out so that you know where to go dig them out.
Right.
So that's the sport. It's called a badger dig. And they had all these big tongs and things like that. So the whole point was you found the badger, and then you dug down until you could get the badger, and then a lot of times you would bag it. Some people had it as vermin, but it was also a sport as well. So when it's a sport, you had people developing these terriers that would be well-suited. They had the great personality for it, their tenaciousness and fearlessness. But then those short legs allowed them to be down in the chamber and bay, so they fight with tongue, not with teeth, except for some exceptions like my breed, the Glen of the Mall. But they badger the badger. So the badger would turn around, try and dig away, and the terrier would dart forward and not let them get away until they could be captured. So they need to stay underground where it's hot and stuffy, so they had to have good room for heart and lungs to be underground. So what this useful thing is to have very short legs and a normal sized body. So with the dwarf breeds, a lot of times people go long and low, long and low, long and low, but they're really not long and low. They're a medium-sized dog or a medium-small or a medium-large on very shortened legs. So if you extend it in the Basset Hound standard, their illustrated standard has great drawing in it where they just draw two sets of legs, basically what the legs would look like if they weren't dwarfed and what the Basset Hound looks like. And really, the dog looks much more like that's what happens. So we look at it, and because they look long, that there's a sense that they're long, but the people who breed these dogs know you really are not wanting a long dog, particularly long in the loin. You're wanting a proportional dog with their head and their neck and their body with good heart and lung capacity, and then you have these short legs. And that's one of them, the badger specialists, or sometimes fox and otter are getting down, but particularly where they can stay down underground. And you have the corgis. So you have dachshund, which means badger dog, and corgi means dwarf dog, corgi. And Basset actually means low. So they named any dogs that had this, that they would just be low dogs. So they're all, it's just what language did you speak? So it was just a way of expressing that the dog was a dwarf, which is obviously very recognizable. So they found that the corgis, both kinds, are very useful in herding where it was required, where the like cows, where they would kick, because they could kick right over their head, and they herd by nipping at heels and things like that. So they're very well suited to this. And then you have the two kinds of corgis, which Cardigan being older and more of the antique type, which we'll talk about in just a second. And then they came more from that Teckel or Dachshund line. And then the Pembrokes came with the addition of some of those Spitz type dogs, as they call them.
That bring
the difference. And so there is a very big difference in understanding. And most people look and go, oh, how do you tell one from the other? Well, the Pem has a bob tail and the Cardi has a long tail. And the problem is now in a lot of countries where they don't allow tail docking anymore, you're going to have both of them with tails. So one of the ways of telling them is this whole idea of how the wraparound front and the feet turn out.
Right.
And in looking at the two breeds, which help people understand the proper construction for their breed specific dog. And then the Basset hounds, this is another really useful, because it's thought that the Glen of Amal Terriers, which are the only dwarf and the only dwarfed dog in Ireland, that there's many, many in the UK, but they think that the actual introduction of the dwarfing gene came from when Queen Elizabeth sent French mercenaries over to this incredibly poor, battened down area in Ireland. And the Glen of Amal is only about 10 square miles, and it's like a fortress. Hard to get in and hard to get out and hard to dig out a rebellion. So she sent some over, and they brought what they called their low slung hounds with them, because they were poorer. So they don't have horse hounds, because nobody had horses. They wanted to have a foot hound. And that's a big part of what Bassets are able to do, is not just their short legs. That helps them sniff the ground very well with their ears. And then they have that white tip on their tail. So as traveling forward, you can keep up with them on foot. So these are jobs that we understand very well. But every year at Westminster, or sometimes the big dog shows, when they say Glen of Amal Terrier, a what of a what? And they will say, oh, it's the turnspit dog. Like, people actually even know what a turnspit is anymore. And with breed aficionados, like you'll have with the Rhodesian Ridgebacks, go, no, our dogs do not kill lions. So it sort of has, a Glen of Amal Terrier could be a turnspit dog, which is exactly the definition of purpose. So any dwarf dog could be a turnspit dog, and they have a stuffed one in Wales. You just need to be of sufficient size. A turnspit is like a hamster wheel. So they would run on the bottom of it, which would make the wheel turn around. It's a labor-saving device to like turn meat or churn butter or something like that. So the dog has to keep going on it, and they have to fit under the spoke, which is going to be in the middle. So they have to have short legs, or they can't fit on the bottom half of it. So this is exactly what is meant by purpose bred. Long before we knew what these dogs were, like Basset hounds or things, you just describe the dogs as what the job that they did.
Right.
And now we've named the dogs by what the job they did, and try and keep them true to be able to be fit for their function. And some functions we do still do, and some we don't do. But that's what people do when they try to get the breed standard like this.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute.
How much is that dog in the window?
Okay, crew. I hear it pretty much every day now. I love pure dog talk. And that makes my heart happy, because I love doing it. I started hosting Pure Dog Talk as a way to reach out to members of our community with education and resources to enable you to succeed and move forward in your goals and ambitions. And your response has been literally overwhelming. The podcast has been downloaded well over 250,000 times to date. That's incredible. All of this information is free to exhibitors around the world at the touch of a button. But here's the reality check. Money really does make the world go round, guys. So I created a special patrons group. This funding source helps cover the expenses of audio editing and website hosting and technology and like that. Patrons keep Pure Dog Talk's fountain of knowledge flowing freely. And like the NPR of dogdom, our patrons support Pure Dog Talk with monthly gifts. We even offer advertising and sponsorship opportunities that you guys may not have known about. So drop me a note, laura@puredogtalk.com, and I'll let you know how you can help share the love.
I think that one of the questions, and I said, is that people will ask me a lot is about the wraparound front. And that is what you brought up in the beginning. And it's very important to understand this, and it works very well. And you can take the wraparound front and go to the other short-legged breeds too. Like, I know you're from Clumber, so you have a short-legged breed, but it has a slightly different front construction. And then you can go to the even wider breeds that are going to have more of a rolling gait. So this is how it affects the gait, like the Pekingese and and the Bulldogs. Yep. So when you understand how the front construction works, you can understand what the proper movement is. And especially what you need to understand is why some dogs will have turnout and what that turnout is for. So if these old standards use words like crooked and bowed, and people don't necessarily know what they mean because we've retained the old language without really understanding what it was they were talking about when they did it.
Right. So let's talk about the wraparound fronts, and we'll start with the ones who have turnout, because I think those are fascinating. And as you say, sort of antique characteristics. And then we can move on to some of the other short-legged dogs with wraparound fronts in terms of like the Clumber and the Sussex and some of those that aren't as turned out and have sort of a different construction.
Absolutely. So there was a website, blog post of Jane Harvey, Jane Dogs. She does really fascinating reviews of a lot of the breed. And she had this great, this is what really jazzed my interest, is that she ranked all the short-legged terriers, and she ranked them to help understand how the front construction worked by the depth of the chest. So we know from, if you look at the standards, they'll say, where does the chest fall in relation to the legs? So what we're always going to see with a wraparound front, the wrap is going to come when the chest is below the level of the legs rather than up on top of it, because it's going to basically end up going in and out. But before we go there, I think it's really important to understand the foundation before you put the furnishings on. So one of the main things I see people getting confused with is actually just what the front assembly bones are. So the most common one being saying that these short-legged dogs have a short upper arm. And in fact, it's the long-legged terriers that have the short upper arm.
Right.
And all of the dwarf breeds or the achondroplastic breeds, all of them are going to specify that the scapula, which is if you start at the wither of the dog and you come down to the point of the shoulder, you have this, you can palpate that ridge that's on top of the shoulder blade. And then the upper arm is what goes from the front of the dog back to the elbow.
Correct.
So when you're wanting to look at what you're really going to need in these dogs is so important. And we see it missing in a lot of breeds in a lot of different ways, is that return. What people say is that, do you see the 90 degree angle? And do you see that length between the point of the shoulder in front going back to the elbow, that there should be plenty in front of the foreleg so that the dog is well balanced? Because these dogs are all front loaded and they need to have legs that are going to support where they're heaviest.
Right.
For the terriers and the dachshund, is there's a very important relationship here in how they dig. So the three parts of the arms in the front construction, you have the scapula, which goes forward, the upper arm, which goes back, and then what people often say the upper arm, but it's actually the forearm, and it's two bones there, the radius and ulna. And that's also going to be responsible for some of these turnout things. Then you go down to the wrist, which is also part of the turnout. But in front of that front, you have the actual front of the dog. So you're going to have that prosternum, which in these breeds, it's always emphasized. And if it's appropriate, it feels sort of like a door stopper. You should be able to feel straightforward And then if you put your hand from the front, that prosternum, and all the judges' education things will say, you examine the dog by putting your hand between and all the way back to feel the length of the keel or the whole sternum. And it's very important in these dogs because that's what's going to protect their organs. And especially for any of the dogs like the Dachshund and the Glen and the Scotty, they're going to actually be able to rest on that keel and dig right. while they're underground because their elbows aren't in the rocky dirt. That sternum is what's lower, and then their arms are free. And they have to have muscles there because when they dig like a person doing a breaststroke when they're swimming. They throw the dirt out to the side like the badger does, whereas most of the other terriers, they throw it between right. their legs. So then they pile dirt up behind them, and that's why we have to dig them out. They both dig very fast and efficiently, but the ones that throw it between their legs, they would swim like a dog paddle. Like if you put your,
right.
if you hung your arms at your side and just moved your hands up and down very vigorously, you're going to have that sense of the elbows being, the legs being below that center of gravity. So it's just mm-hmm. a different digging style, and that should be reflected. So in Jane Harvey's, as she went through, she said, if you look at the front construction with that depth of chest, and she ranked them, that the only one that really has the turnout with their wraparound front, which is the whole shoulder construction, the shoulder blade, then the upper arm, it's got to go out and then come back in, and the legs are going to be underneath of the dogs to help support.
Right.
Underneath the dog, as opposed to legs that are out to the side, like a Pekingese or the Bulldog, which don't have the base of the support underneath the dog. They have it out to the sides. And that is why they're going to roll back and forth from side to side instead of spiral out. The Glen has the deepest chest, and they are the only ones that have that antique feature of the double turnout. So they wrap, but then there has to be turnout to balance the wrap because the chest descends the farthest in the Glen of them all. And if you see these maximum substance for size dwarf dogs, which would be the Glen, the Cardigan, the Basset Hound, they're the ones where you're going to see that turnout still be permissible because it isn't just the depth of the chest, but they have so much substance. The bone is enough that they have to accommodate that. But it should never be excessive, and it should always be in proportion. Now, the next three breeds in terms of depth of chest, which is the Scotty would be next, and they say it shouldn't rest on the legs, but it should hang down between them. And this is going to be like that egg in an egg cup
right.
sense or heart-shaped. See also with the Corgi that they are also dig in that fashion where they throw the dirt out to the side. And a slight amount of turnout is going to be permissible in the Scotties, the Dandies, and the Skye Terriers, which have a little bit more of this. You know, straight is moving away from the antique feature. That's the more modern. But if you look at any of these dogs in the old paintings, you'll see, and Dachshunds especially, crooked legs and turned out. So the crook and then the turnout accommodate each other, and that's balanced.
The turnout you're talking about, just for clarification, if people aren't familiar with some of these breeds, you're talking about the front feet being pointed in different directions, basically, right? Like in a regular dog, we would think it was bad because it was easty-westy. In these breeds, it's good.
It's good, but only to the amount that balances the overall. It's sort of how you would stand if you were carrying a big load. You don't want to hold your feet close together and straight up underneath. You'd sort of spread them a little bit apart and slightly turn out your feet. It just gives a little bit wider base of support. So that is why in the Corgis, you're going to see that the Cardigan, which is a heavier bone dog and a bigger dog, and because it's longer, there's a little more weight on the front that way. They have the turnout in their feet, whereas the Pembrokes are going to say the leg should be as straight as possible. So there still can be straight with a wraparound front. It's just what happens to the leg after that. So the turnout then comes, does the dog have two places where the legs are crooked? So the turned out ones with the wraparound front are going to be those bigger, heavier dogs, whereas every one of the other dogs, you're going to start trying to get the legs straightened out. And that's also modernized, meaning the toes point straight forward. You know, if they say most of the people are looking like around 11 and 1,
right?
There's never anything functional about having easty-westy.
Right.
A fiddle front is always going to be undesirable, which would mean the front legs, the forelegs, they're very close together, and then the feet turn out very opposite directions. So they come very far in and go very far out. And there's no sense that there would be a job that sort of construction would ever help a dog. It's not going to help them move forward freely, and it's not going to help them dig better. It's just poor construction. It's a poor front, no matter how you look at it. So most of the standards are going to point that out as being very undesirable.
Excellent. That was a good, I wanted that clarification between the wraparound front and the fiddle front specifically. I thought that's important for people to understand.
And then that really helps in terms of the fiddle front, because it has both the sense, like both the legs look like they're duct taped together. I mean, to me, when I look at it, it looks like that three-legged race, you know, that you see. It looks weird. Like the dog would have to be very narrow. And the point of these dogs is they're usually very sturdy. But when you get to like the Sussex and the Clumber, they're going to have some sort of sense of that smoothness of everything wrapping around. But the emphasis there is on that width of their chest.
Right.
And to accommodate that and still have those sturdy, strong legs, they're not going to wrap, and fiddling would be extremely bad in a breed like that, where they're just supposed to move forward very strongly. And in order to do that, because they're not going to spiral their leg out and around, they're going to move straight forward, you're going to see that they roll slightly from side to side because the legs are more on the sides. And you could see this if you just held your hands up in front like you're going to play patty cake with your hands facing forward close to your body and just sort of rotate your body from side to side. That would be an exaggerated roll. But that's what happens when you have a shorter leg, to put them down one after the other. But then you get into the extremes, and the extreme also tells you the function. To me, the most extreme by far is the Pekingese, right? They like completely roll, and their function is to never be able to get away from you. So they literally can't move fast enough.
Well, they were good lap dogs. Come on now.
That they kind of just roll back and forth, and they can hardly get any forward movement at all. So it's exaggerated, but that would be, you know, something that would be appealing in a companion or toy dog, is you don't ever have to go very far to get them. They can't run away from you. They can't go any faster than you. But I tell you that short legs don't mean that they can't move, because I have many wire dachshunds that can really cover ground. It's amazing with the efficiency that they do that. But you don't want to see hurried. You just want to see that ground covering. And that's what they need, that length of upper arm, because they're going to spiral the arm out in front. They drive from behind and they're free in the front. So that movement should still stay like that. So these dogs, even with short legs, can really, really cover a lot of ground. All of the terriers like that. They want that freedom of movement. And generally when they move in a stilted fashion, which starts to look, well, stilted is the wrong word because that's more like a shot, but, you know, more like the fox terrier, the pendulum gait. When you see this, that really is coming because the front construction isn't ideal. The shoulder is straight, the neck isn't quite right, there isn't that return in the upper arm. But in the dwarf dogs, they sort of unfold that whole arm and it just gets out of, kind of squashed, you know what I mean? Like if you looked at it from the side, there's length there, but it's folded on top of each other. So it sort of folds itself out and they can move quite freely. But most of those standards are again going to go, the focus is on the drive and then the front has to stay out of the way. And again, you have to have the correct angles to be able to do that.
Excellent. All right, crew, we are back with Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. And Allison has some really good input, particularly with the summer months upon us, about dogs that are blowing coat and how to manage this avalanche of fur.
That's right. So I was lucky enough that I had an excellent mentor when I was really young. And even though my family had poodles and Afghan hounds, we always bathed them once a week. If they were matting or blowing their coat, the Afghans, then we would bath them twice a week to really get that dead hair out. And then the first person that I went and worked with showed double-coated breeds that were bathed every week. And, you know, they were always in decent coat. It never seemed like they blew their coat to the point where they couldn't be shown. And then later in life, I met more people with double-coated breeds who didn't bath them very often. They bathed them maybe three times a year. And if they were blowing coat, they barely brushed them. They, you know, just tried to keep all that hair in there. And that just went against everything that I've ever been taught and what's worked for me. And even talking to some people who have successfully shown double-coated breeds that seem to always be in a decent amount of hair, the trick is to bath them. You need to bath them. You need to rake all that dead hair out, because that's the only way you're leaving room for the new hair to grow back in.
Exactly.
And you were telling me about your hot water trick, Laura.
Yeah, this is one of my favorites. When I showed a lot of Akitas, of course, they're going to dump their coat twice a year. And Akitas are particularly bad, like puppies. You know, they get that fluffy puppy hair. Oh, my gosh. And so you're trying to get this out because it looks like they have pom-poms on their hip bones.
Yeah,
and
right.
My trick that I learned was we always would wash the Akitas in cool water or even cold water to help them keep their coat. But when they're blowing coat, when they're dumping that coat out, we would wash them in warm, I mean, verging on hot, as warm as they could take it. And that would help loosen up the hair so that then when you did your force drying and your brushing, all that dead coat then would come out faster. It was amazing.
Right. You know, I've done that myself. When I had some Shetland sheepdogs that were my own, we were showing a bitch that went on to become the all-time top winning bitch in Canadian history. And she went through a really, really bad coat blow in the summer. Mm-hmm. And what we did is we ended up washing her twice a week. And not only did her hair look better while we were showing it, just because it was clean and had like no buildup, but her hair came in much, much faster as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the way the dog hair follicles work. You know, you can't put two in one little follicle. You got to get the dead one out so a new one will grow.
Right, exactly.
Awesome. All right, Pure Dog Talk listeners, don't forget Pure Dog Talk 25 at the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy, particularly now our new subscription service, right, Allison?
That's right, Laura. We are switching to a subscription service with you get everything that is in our school. So there's 500 videos, there's PDFs, there's ebooks, and we are adding new content every week. So that's all yours for one low monthly price.
Nice, which you get a discount from if you're a Pure Dog Talk listener. So I think exactly. That's a win-win.
It's definitely a win-win.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Allison.
Thank you, Laura.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.